You are listening to your daily dose of well-being and inspiration on Law of Attraction Radio Network at LOARadionetwork.com. Hear this incredible show on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, which goes through your car stereos with Ford Sync or any auto dashboard that has the internet. Listen to our 24/7 broadcast with our mobile app as well, or just listen through an MP3 player or computer. Remember, LOARadionetwork.com, heard in over 120 countries, is the radio station for your well-being.
Welcome to the Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from absolutely beautiful and joyful Southern California on this Memorial Day weekend. I am taking the time this weekend to bask in the sun and to bring back fabulous memories of my dad, my mom, and all my siblings as we grew up together. We had such a tremendous life. I am remembering my grandparents and my aunts and cousins and my many wonderful friends and lovers who chose to leave this life early. I am filling my heart with gratitude for all they gave me. I do feel so blessed to have known each one of them. So while it's the holiday weekend, I thought I would put on one of my favorite shows that expresses everything that this weekend is about. And next week, I'll be back with an incredible astrologer from Hawaii, Tom Lesher, who will be giving us the June astrological forecast. He is terrific, so you're going to want to tune in. But right now, even though this show aired originally in 2009, its value remains the same. So listen in while I chat with Neil Donald Walsh. Have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend.
You are listening to your daily dose of well-being and inspiration on Law of Attraction Radio Network at LOARadionetwork.com. Hear this incredible show on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, which goes through your car stereos with Ford Sync or any auto dashboard that has the internet. Listen to our 24/7 broadcast with our mobile app as well, or just listen through an MP3 player or computer. Remember, LOARadionetwork.com, heard in over 120 countries, is the radio station for your well-being.
Well, welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from beautiful Southern California, and I'm especially happy you're here with us tonight because we're going to talk about the brand new DVD called Infinity, The Ultimate Trip, which happens to be about the journey beyond death. We're going to have a conversation with Neil Donald Walsh, who is featured in the film, and the author of those fabulous books called A Conversation with God. So we're going to be talking about a happy subject, death. It's time we shift our attitude about this, and I think tonight's show is not only going to be fascinating, but incredibly freeing. It's going to be one that you will always remember, so stay tuned. Ah, looking out on that tropical night, having a romantic conversation with your possible soulmate, or hitting one of the 7 nightclubs on the ship to dance the night away, then sitting back and listening to fantastic workshops that help you to nurture that relationship into something you've never experienced before. You may think it's just a dream, but it can be a reality on our Spiritual Singles Cruise, October 27th to October 31st. We made a last-minute cabin buy so that we could extend the original group rates, which still start off at $599. So don't delay. Sign up now and start manifesting the love you have been waiting for. Go to LOARadionetwork.com.
The University of Attraction, the place where you learn from international scientists, medical doctors, spiritual leaders, and experts in the field of the Law of Attraction. At the university, you will receive tools to harmonize both sides of your brain with free hypnosis and meditations recordings. View or listen to the courses that will shape the way you react to life. And don't forget, your participation allows Law of Attraction Radio Network to bring empowering messages to every country in the world. Change your life while empowering the world. Go to LOARadionetwork.com. Let the classes begin.
Hey, I have a story I want to share with you that was sent to me by my longtime friend Sandy in San Marcos, California. It's called How to Dance in the Rain. It was a busy morning about 8:30 a.m. when an elderly gentleman in his 80s arrived to have stitches removed from his thumb. He said he was in a hurry as he had an appointment at 9 a.m. I took his vital signs and had him take a seat, knowing it would be over an hour before someone would be able to see him. And I saw him looking at his watch and decided, well, since I was not busy with another patient, I would evaluate his wound. And upon exam, it was well healed, so I talked to the doctors and got the needed supplies to remove his sutures and redress his wound. While taking care of this, I asked him if he had another doctor's appointment this morning, as he was in such a hurry. The gentleman told me no. He needed to go to the nursing home to have breakfast with his wife. I inquired as to her health. He told me she had been in the nursing home for a while and that she had Alzheimer's disease. As we talked, I asked if she would be upset if he was just a bit late. And he replied that she no longer knew who he was, that she had not recognized him in over 5 years now. Well, I was surprised, and I asked him, "And you still go every morning, even though she doesn't know who you are?" He smiled as he patted my hand and says, "Well, she doesn't know me, but I still know who she is." I had to hold back the tears as he left, and I had goosebumps on my arms, and I thought, "Now that's the kind of love I want in my life." But the truth is, true love is neither physical nor romantic. True love is an acceptance of all that is, has been, will be, and will not be. The happiest people don't necessarily have the best of everything. They just make the best of everything they have. You know, life isn't about how to survive the storm, but how to dance in the rain. And that was authored by Jill Gleason. Thank you, Jill. You know, we're at the close of 2009 and the start of a brand new year. So let's make 2010 the year that no matter what kind of contrast comes up, we're just going to hop right into that vortex and dance and dance and dance. Remember, it's our choice to be happy or miserable. Well, hey, come join me in the happiness vortex. Now, on with tonight's show. Neil Donald Walsh is a modern-day spiritual messenger whose words continue to touch the world in profound ways. With an early interest in religion and deeply felt connection to spirituality, Neil spent the majority of his life thriving professionally, yet searching for spiritual meaning before beginning his now famous Conversation with God. In his With God series of books that has been translated in 34 languages, Neil has touched millions of lives and inspiring important changes in everyone's day-to-day lives. Another book that I want you all to take notice of is Neil's book called Happier Than God. It is pure gold, and we'll be talking about this, as well as the DVD called Infinity, The Ultimate Trip, in which Neil is featured along with Greg Braden, Brian Weiss, and many others. It's going to be a great show, so let's get going. Welcome, Neil, to the Law of Attraction Talk Radio. After following you for decades, I am so honored to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I don't know why you'd be terribly honored, but it's nice to be here with you for sure. I'm just an ordinary human being like all the rest of us, but thank you for those kind words.
Neil, we're here today to talk about this really great DVD called Infinity, The Ultimate Trip, which is a journey beyond death. Why is it so important that we discuss death right now?
Well, I don't know if it's more important to discuss right now than at any other time, but it might seem in our illusion to be more important because, you know, everything is moving so rapidly to today. Number one, the first thing that I notice about all of this is that life is moving so quickly for people and bringing us, therefore, closer and closer, more rapidly, or at least in our illusion, to the experience of our transition moment, of our continuation day. So I think it's fair to say, secondarily, we are in a time when death is being visited upon the planet in some very strange and sad and unfortunate and frankly scary ways. That is, we're confronting death all the time, every time we pick up the newspaper, in ways we never thought we would before. Little children are pushing other little children out of seven-story windows in Chicago. Police people are walking into donut shops in Seattle or Tacoma and just randomly shooting four policemen and killing them on the spot. To say nothing of the larger conflicts that we have on the planet between terrorists and other warring factions around the world, and adding to all that, the increasing environmental disasters, Katrina and being one of them, and the tsunami being another, that are being caused by our degradation of the environment. And then you add to all of that the health problems that we're facing, the H1N1 flu, the so-called swine flu, and other health problems. In other words, I think it's fair to observe that humanity is being confronted with the experience of death and the death of our loved ones and our own impending death with increasing and ever more dramatic experiences and observations that are being placed before us by the news media all the time. And this is finally the final, I was almost going to say, to use a turn of phrase, the final nail in the coffin, which is an unfortunate turn of phrase, but really the final nail in the coffin is the fact that we can't get away from it. The instantaneous nature of the communication these days, from CNN to Fox News to our internet, Twitter, and MySpace and so forth, places us into instant communication with everyone just about that we know and a lot of people in the world we don't know on an almost daily, I would say almost hourly, sometimes even a minute-to-minute basis. I mean, a person can't go out for a cup of coffee in Chicago without tweeting somebody that he's doing that. And so we're aware of each other, I want to say. We are aware of each other and therefore of ourselves, probably more self-aware now and more aware of life than humanity has ever been before in its own collective history. I think that's a fair observation, and that's the reason why it seems as though it's really important for us to talk not only about death, but about life and what we really are doing here, who we are, why are we here, what are we attempting to do, and what is this place in which we find ourselves, and is there a larger purpose and a larger reason for life, and therefore is there a larger experience following what we call physical life that we might be better made aware of? That would be my answer to your question.
In the DVD, The Infinity, you talked about your personal experience with the energy field. That was absolutely brilliant. It gave me such great insight into that complex question of what is this energy field around us. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, my. Yes, I can. I said, oh, my, because it's really a detailed description that might be somewhat boring for people, but when I've had three out-of-body experiences in my life, but one was, I think, more significant to me than the other two. One was just a dramatic experience in which I was, and I'll go right to the heart of the matter, in which I was placed before the what I later learned to be the field of collective energy. I was seeing life, if you please, at the sub molecular level, and it's and I realized ultimately I realized that what I was looking at, what I was observing, was the basic, the very essence of life itself, in its primary form, the singular energies of life. And here's what it looked like to me. I thought I experienced looking at a million, kajillion, kazillion individual shimmering particles, of what I would define now as energy. And these particles were shimmering and pulsating, and they contained the richest colors you could ever have imagined, the deepest greens and the most wonderful blues and the reddest reds and the brightest yellows, just the extraordinary different colors. And they were all attached, that is, touching each other. These particles of energy were pulsating in connection with each other, like so many puzzle pieces, if you please. And what was happening as I looked at this field of energy is that each of those individual puzzle pieces would blink on and off. That is, they would kind of turn into themselves and blink on and off. And as they did, they would change both color and shape. And what happened is that the adjoining particles would accommodate. They would likewise blink on and off and change shape to accommodate the changing shape of the first, and so forth. And so what you saw was a field of pulsating, vibrating elements or individual particles. I believe I was looking at the building blocks of life itself, the smallest particles of the essential energy that is. And in an ever-changing array of altering colors and shapes, just almost like a heartbeat in a sense. Perhaps one might even metaphorically say the heartbeat of the universe. But it was so beautiful. The colors were so awesomely beautiful. And by the way, I should tell you that this had a particular impact on me because I'm colorblind. I have not completely colorblind, but I have an 85% color deficiency. That is, I see only 15% of the colors. And so for me to see this, and I knew instantly what I was seeing, which is interesting. My mind wouldn't have known because my mind has never seen those colors, but my soul understood, this is green, this is blue, this is red. And I knew that instinctively, intuitively. And so here I am looking at this incredible experience, and I wanted to get close. It was so beautiful, and not only did it have physical beauty, that is, it was beautiful to my sight, but it was also beautiful to my feeling center. That is, it felt wonderful. I can't even describe the feeling except of it goes past euphoria, past bliss, into a much more calm feeling, a feeling of intense, peaceful serenity. And deeply happy serenity. And so there I was in this field of feeling and awareness. And I, of course, wanted to move closer to it. My first impulse was to just be there and be one with it, be united with it. So I tried to, I was without a body, of course, and I realized that I was just experiencing, you know, my own consciousness, my own awareness without a body. But I tried to somehow move my awareness as if I did have a body closer to this field that was in front of me. But every time I tried to get closer to it, it would recede. I would try to move closer to it in consciousness, it would recede. And I remember thinking to myself, maybe I'll trick it. I'm going to pretend to move forward, and then very rapidly I'm going to go left or right to see if I can catch it on one of its sides, because I realized it was surrounding me. So I tried to move forward, but then I darted to the left in my consciousness, you know, this kind of mental games you play with yourself, and of course it moved away again. And there was no way I could get closer to it, and I began to feel very frustrated and very sad. It was almost a feeling of a child, really, almost a four-year-old child, just saying to himself, I just wanted to get closer. Come on, play with me. And it wouldn't. And then I heard a voice that said, in a sense, almost silly you. You can't get closer to it if you wanted to, because it is you. You can no sooner get close, no more get closer to this experience, this essence, this energy, than you could move your eyes closer to your nose. Because as you move forward, it moves forward with you, because you are it. You are already in it. You are already a part of it. And as you move, it moves. And that's not moving away from you. It's moving with you. It is, in fact, you doing the moving. You doing the seeing and being seen. And so you are the seer and the seen. And it is just very difficult for me to describe this because I get very emotional. And this happened years ago. This out-of-body experience wasn't last week or last month. We're talking 20 years ago. And it might as well have been last week or this morning, because every time I describe it to anyone, I move right back into the experience that I had in that moment. Now, my total out-of-body experience was much broader and much longer than that. It included many other experiences as well. But I can tell you that when I came, how do I put this? when I came back from that out-of-body experience and returned to my body, I knew things intuitively. I knew things cellularly in the cells of my body that my mind could not possibly have ever hoped to know mentally. And I realized that there are two levels of knowing in the human experience. One either knows something mentally, or one knows something at the level of soul, at the level of beingness. And those things that we know, it is impossible to forget, and if we stay in touch with that level of knowing, it's impossible to ignore. And here's the one knowing that I came away with from all of this. Now, this is going to sound so pedantic, so simple, so elementary, so simplistic that I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but I know I've had the experience that we are all one. Not simply somebody saying that to me or somebody's theory or concept about it. I have actually experienced the oneness, because what I realized was that what I was looking at, this field of energy all around me, was not simply my field of energy, but the field of energy of all of life. That I was not looking at nealness, but lifeness, all of life. And I absolutely, and my other out-of-body experiences surrounding the one I've described, convinced me beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's no separation between anything. And I've come back to my physical form with a deep awareness of that. And from that awareness emerged what later became conversations with God.
Wow. So that was before the conversations with God.
Before conversations with God by many years. It was one of the early openings in my life when I was, gosh, I see in my 30s or early 40s, probably in my 30s, and I don't recall the exact time now, but and it was one of three out-of-body experiences that I had in my life that really altered my life dramatically.
So after you had this experience, was there an expansion of your knowingness?
It's not something that evolves in the sense of increasing or growing or becoming other than what it was originally. A knowingness is a knowingness, and it's usually complete in its knowing, and it doesn't get any larger. It's like love. You walk down the street and you run into a person at a coffee shop or wherever, on the bus, who knows where, and somehow, for some reason, you can't even articulate and wouldn't even attempt to articulate it. In fact, you don't have any desire to articulate it. You simply want to feel more of it. You suddenly feel in love, love at first sight. People have had those experiences. I've had those experiences. Many people have had. Most people have had. And you can't, you know, and that kind of love, that kind of, which is a complete overcoming of the self by the self, as the self, That kind of overcoming of with love is indescribable, and it doesn't grow. It doesn't evolve. It doesn't become something more 3 days from now than what it was, because the reason that it is so overpowering in the first instance is that you're experiencing all of it. You know, eros, you know, sexual, romantic love, agape, friendly, brotherly love, filial piety, familial love. The whole of what love is in the human experience at every level, you experience in that moment, and there are no words for it, mm-hmm. and there's no growing of it. It's overwhelming and overpowering because it's total and complete in that moment. It's the closest thing I can describe to this. So to answer your question, I know I'm not giving you the answer you want to hear, but in fact, there was no evolving of that particular notion of the oneness of all things. So there was just simply a complete and utter knowingness of it, as absolutely true, and you cannot expand absolute truth or evolve it or grow into it. It's simply there. What did happen through the years is that I began to be more, I started to mention this just a minute ago, and I didn't quite get into it. I started to, through the years, it didn't evolve, but what did alter, what did change, was my conviction that what I had come to know and what I had experienced was absolutely true. In other words, when one returns from those kinds of out-of-body experiences, and I've had two others as well, the first thing the mind will do is cause you to doubt everything you've just experienced. Oh, that's silly, or it's your imagination, you're making it all up, or a flight of fancy, or whatever your mind wants to convince you that it is. And so here we are, I'm trying to hold center and trying to hold on to this experience, and my mind is chattering at me all the way that I just made it all up, it's just a flight of imagination, as I mentioned, and so forth and so on. Even though at a cellular level, I knew completely, utterly, and absolutely that this was the true nature of things. But to hold on to that knowing, so what did happen was not that my experience of my knowingness evolved, but what did alter, what did expand, was my deep-seated conviction. As I began hearing from other people, as I began reading the works of others, as I began diving into the works of the world's great mystics, and our contemporary spiritual teachers as well, Deepak Chopra and Marianne Williamson and Eckhart Tolle talking about the wonderful moment of now, and Byron Katie and all the rest, I was just nodding my head going, yes, 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 okay, I'm not crazy. And that enlarged my sense of deep conviction that if so many of us are having the same or nearly the same experience, I couldn't possibly have made it up. It must be, in fact, as Werner Erhard, lovely Werner Erhard would say, it must be, what so?
So bottom line, this experience showed you that there is no such thing as death.
Yes, that is correct. Death, of course, is, I always laugh when I hear that, because the word death, as people understand it, and as people imagine it is experienced, it's almost laughable to me in a joyful way. It's just like I'm laughing with joy, as one would laugh when one realizes that one got all the answers on the test correct, even though one thought that one failed. It's that kind of laughter where you're certain you failed the exam, and the professor comes in and says, you passed, and you just, oh, wow. It's that kind of laughter that I think of when I hear people say the word death, because I know the baggage that the word and the idea and the concept carries for the largest number of people. And I just laugh like someone who's just gotten the answer to the exam, because I realize it's not that way at all. And so the way people think of this death, the termination of things, the end of things, and even those people who realize it's not a termination, but that life goes on, but even their ideas of what happens after death are also, in a joyous way, laughable. That is, they're simply inaccurate at the highest level. They're completely inaccurate, as I understand it. And so I laugh with joy to tell and joyously share with others what really is going on in this experience that we have called death. I'd be happy to summarize it for you. And I'm not going to say anything new to anyone who's listening to this program, because I know that people who are predisposed to listen to a program like this already in the ballpark with me. So they're going to be yawning like, yeah, so what's new? But presuming we have somebody else that might not be in that same space listening, I'll be happy to tell you that, number one, of course, as we all know, death does not exist. There's no such thing as death. That is, there's no such thing as the end of life. That life is merely a changing of form. I was told by God, In a wonderful statement, this is the most wonderful statement I think I've ever heard about death. God said to me, Neil, death is a process of re-identification. And what I got, and then I was shown, and what I got from that was that at the moment that we call death, we simply and immediately re-identify ourselves. We become more fully and profoundly aware, that is, absolutely aware, of our true identity, of who we really are. And I was told in a conversation with God that this occurs it was described to me in three stages. Of course, in order for stages to exist, time has to exist, and time does not exist. But for the purposes of trying to explain something linearly, we will say that this process occurs in three stages. The first thing that occurs after we do the thing that we call die is that we disidentify or detach from any thought that we are the body. And people who have had out-of-body experiences can already describe this particular part of the process. They look down, they see themselves on the operating table or by the roadside by the car crash or whatever, and they realize, oh, that's not me, because I'm over here looking at me. So what is that down there? I don't know what that is, but I'm clear it's not me because I'm over here looking at it. Therefore, I'm clear that I am not that. Now, I've had that experience. In my out-of-body experience, I had exactly that experience. So I was aware, again, experientially, not conceptually, not theoretically, but experientially aware, I am not my body. And that's the first thing that everyone becomes aware of when they do this thing that we popularly call die. Once we disattach from our body, the next step is that we disidentify with our mind. We become clear that we are not our mind because we find ourselves, even as we do in life, by the way, watching our own thoughts. We think about what we're thinking about. And then we go to the third level. We think about who's thinking about what we're thinking about. Who is that? And as soon as we ask that profound Aristotelian question, who is the thinker and who is the thinker of the thoughts? Who's thinking about the thoughts I'm thinking about? Who is that? Once we get clear that there is something there that's thinking about the thoughts we're having, we're very, very clear that we are not our mind. We say, oh, I see. I'm the thinker of my thoughts, but I am not my thoughts. I am not my mind. Well, then, who is thinking the thoughts that I'm thinking about? Who's that person, three or four deep in the hall of mirrors? And then we usually come up with, oh, I get it. I'm my soul. That must be my soul. So we disidentify with the body at stage two. At stage three, we actually release any notion that we even are the soul, that is the individual soul that I would call Neil's soul. As we move more rapidly and more completely into, here we go now, and I know that everyone from Danny and Brinkley on down has talked about heading toward the light, moving toward the light, but in fact, that is a metaphor that is very apt because my own experience and my own out-of-body encounter was identical. That idea, that feeling, that sense of moving down the dark tunnel rapidly with insane speed, but not frightening speed, toward the light. And the brightest, most warm and welcoming and engulfing light that one could possibly conceive of or imagine. And once we merge with that light, we are aware that we are not even the individuation we would have called Neil's soul or my friend Danyan Brinkley, a lovely friend of mine, or Danyan's soul or your soul, but in fact we are the all of it, and we are simply an aspect of or a singularization of the singularity returning home, melting back into the all of it, and welcomed back with open arms to that which we really are. And that is my description of the first phase of our so-called after-death experience. Much, much more happens beyond that. We reemerge from the all, and we have experiences that allow us to know more about the all that we are, and we examine our lives, the life that we've just lived, through a process that I call Kamaloka, which is an Eastern mystical tradition that talks about life review. Not as a punishment, not as a horrible experience of looking at all the bad things we've done, but simply looking at our life moment to moment. But here's what's interesting about it. I'm told that as we review our lives and look at it from moment to moment, that what we experience is each individual moment of our life is re-experienced, but not from our point of view, but rather from the point of view of every single person who is touched by or impacted by what we were up to in that moment. So that this radio interview that we're doing right now, I will experience again, but from not my point of view, but from yours. And, incidentally, from the point of view of all the many thousands of people listening to both of us right now. So that I will therefore be given the incredible, heavenly, golden opportunity to know the impact and the effect of what I am being, doing, and having right now as it was experienced by thousands of other people.
Wow.
And that is shown to me, by the way, through all the moments of my life. How did it feel to my wife when I spoke more sharply than I wish I had at dinner two nights ago? How did it feel to my children when I grabbed them and hugged them and said, you know, I love you more than anything in the world? What is the experience of that, not inside of me, but inside of all the people in the world who were touched by me, and by extension, who were touched then by them? And so we are allowed to step into that extraordinary level of awareness where we become deeply conscious of the impact and the effect that we have had on every other soul with whom we've been in contact, and the souls with whom those souls have been in contact. Now, by the way, this was all kind of captured. This whole idea that I'm talking to you about was captured in a wonderful movie called It's a Wonderful Life, starring James Stewart, where Clarence the Angel comes down after he dies, after he commits suicide, or attempts to, and Clarence the Angel shows him, you don't understand, you don't understand what you've done here in this community. Let me show you how your life has touched everyone else. Let me show you your life all over again from the point of view of others. And, of course, that's a famous, famous movie. Everyone sees it 15 times every Christmas season. We're about to see it again. And that's, that, in simple terms, that's what I was told occurs during this process called Kamaloka, in which we are allowed to see both what you would call the good and what you would call the bad, the negative and the positive sides of everything that we've done, every thought we've ever had, every idea we've ever spoken, every action we ever took. And the purpose of that is not, by the way, for some big, you know, guy in the sky to say, see that, see that, do you see this? Nya, 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 nya. No, no, no. The purpose of it is for us to go, aha, oh, I see. I see, oh my gosh, I see. And I see, too, on the positive side, oh my goodness, who would have thought that little smile at the bank teller when I was in line would have changed that person's life? Who would have imagined? Oh my gosh. And then we get to come back. God says, would you like now to try again? Would you like now to become physical once more, knowing what you now know, and move through the experience yet one more time, bringing this level of awareness to each moment of your next physicality, that ultimately you might touch people as the Christed One, as the Buddha, as all the great avatars and all the great masters have done throughout human history, moving through life not as the one who needs to be healed, but as the one who's healing by your very presence in the space and by your deep awareness of how every word, every thought, every single gesture touches the lives of other people in ways more profound than you could possibly have imagined. Or as wonderful William Shakespeare put it, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Oh my, how profound. You stated that there is no such thing as time and at the time that we pass over, that we meet our loved ones, whether they be alive or dead, at the same time. That's the first time I've ever heard of that.
Well, yes, you know, we're now talking out of the book, Home with God. We should probably tell our audience, I wrote a book about all of this, and it's called Home with God. In a Life That Never Ends. It's a dialogue book. It's a conversation with God book. A conversation with God. My last one, the final one, the final published one. And in that book, I ask God to please explain to me all that's true about the afterlife experience. And one of the things that I've heard, of course, which most of us listening to this program, are probably already aware and have embraced the notion that when we do the thing called die, we are met on the quote-unquote other side by our loved ones, those who have gone before, our parents perhaps. In my case, both my mom and dad have passed on, and my brothers, and so on and so forth. And they'll all be waiting for us there with a grand reunion and a grand celebration. Fair enough. But I said to God, gosh, you know, as wonderful as that may sound, I still feel kind of sad that with regard to all those I'm leaving behind, my children, hopefully I will precede them in death. My grandchildren and others who are near and dear to me, even the tiniest grandchild just born or the great grandchild just born, I'm gonna feel kind of sad about that. And you know, I have to, how long it'll be before I see my son again or my grandson again. And that kind of, God said, no, you don't understand. I know you think it's that way, because I understand that you are holding the entire experience of your life and your death within the framework of time and space. But my child, she said, time and space do not exist in the way you imagine them to. And there is, in fact, in your understanding, no time and no space. Therefore, you will see these loved ones who you have gone before in no time at all. They'll be there on the other side with you. Not because your death has caused somehow their life to end, but because they lived a rich and full life, but that you meet in the moment of evermore, where there is no time and no space, where you all exist right here, right now, and where you then choose once again to dive back into the pool of our illusions in order to separate the single moment of now into a whole pile of individual moments that we call now and then, before and after, yesterday, today, and tomorrow, so that you might once again experience the fullness and the richness of who you really are, one thing at a time. and one moment at a time. And only through the process of the separation of the individual moment called now into a billion, zillion, kajillion individual moments can you even begin to appreciate, know, understand, or experience, much less express the totality of who you really are.
Neil, can we have a conscious death?
Yes, of course we can. And just as we can have a conscious life. But those of us who walk around in life unconscious, and I include myself in that group more often of the time, most of the time, those of us who walk around through life unconsciously run the risk and stand the chance of moving through the experience we call death unconsciously. On the other hand, those of us who live life with full consciousness or move toward the fullest consciousness that we can, ultimately, often, and I think most often, experience death with full consciousness as well. It is said that the Buddha did this, that again, here we go with all the great masters, that the Christ did this, that Muhammad did this, that and others, not even, we don't even have to speak of religious icons and avatars. People like Gandhi, for instance, you know, did this. Mother Teresa, others, people whose lives were lived at such a high level of consciousness. Paramahansa Yogananda was said to have left his body in this exact state of mind, a state of full awareness of exactly what was going on, why it was going on, what was happening while it was happening, and a total awareness of the entire experience without any sense of fear or agitation at any level whatsoever. I knew a master personally. His name was Francis Tryon. He was called Futsu by all those who knew him. Futsu is a Chinese word, I'm told, meaning master. And Futsu Tryon was the reigning master of a Chinese body-mind-spirit discipline called Gondogao. And I met him through my now former wife, lovely Nancy, with whom I'm no longer married or partnered, but with whom I retain a lifelong friendship, a very cordial and lovely one. But when I was, Nancy and I were married, she was a student of Futsu Tryon, and she introduced me to him. I never became a student of his, but because he told me that I was not to be. He said, no, you are operating at an entirely different level. The fact of the matter is we became very close. And then I watched him die about 2 years after I met him. He died of cancer. And I watched his whole process right up until 3 days before he left the planet and celebrated his continuation day. At no time did I experience him being agitated, upset, frightened, fearful at any level. He was the most serene, calm, peaceful, gentle person. All of his students from around the world, and he had students all over the world who were flying in from Tokyo and flying in from Buenos Aires, who were flying in from all over to be with Futsu, Master Tryon. From everywhere, and he was inviting them into his. And his wife was saying, "Oh no, he's way too tired. He's way too exhausted. He's near, very near death." And he was saying to her, "No, let them in, let them in." And they all came in, and I was among them, so I saw all this happening. And we'd stand around his bed, 15 or 20 of us, as many as you could pack into the bedroom, waiting to hear any word. And of course, most of the time, he was just breathing heavily and just lying there. But every so often, he'd open his eyes and say, "So, what can I tell you about this? What would you like to know? You've traveled so far, and I have traveled so far in my life to be here now, so let us share." And they would ask him, "Futsu, aren't you scared?" He said, "No, what is there to be afraid of?" And then they would say, "Why are you dying like this? If you are a master, why don't you continue living for another 10 or 20 years? And he said, "I'm dying like this to show you how it's done."
Oh.
I stood there, my mouth dropped. I thought, wow, either this guy is making it all up and he's a damn good actor, or he knows something, the knowing of which would change everything.
Wow. What would happen if we all stopped being afraid of death?
What would happen in the world if we stopped being afraid of life?
Wow, that just hit me right between the eyes. But tell me, what would be the benefit for mankind if only we could stop being afraid?
We would live as who we really are. See, all death is a fear of loss. And all loss is the manifestation of a notion that there's something that can be taken away from us. First of all, life. And then during life, something that we value in life, our significant other, or the car outside, or the house that we've been making payments on, or the life of our children, or whatever we think that could be taken from us that would simultaneously rob of us of our peace, our joy, and our serenity. Only when we are clear that nothing can rob us of who we really are, of our peace, our joy, and our serenity, only when we're clear about that can we move through life without anxiety, and therefore without a reason to attack others. You understand that all attack is a call for help, as the Course in Miracles so beautifully puts it. All attack is a call for help. It's an announcement of our notion that somehow we're going to be less in a succeeding moment if we don't do something right now to stop what's going on. And so we have to protect ourselves in the first case, and in the second case, perhaps attack someone else as a form of protection, all arising out of the notion that if this particular person, place, or thing is taken from us, that we will somehow be less than we are right now. That notion, in turn, springs from a larger notion. We are all living a case of mistaken identity. If we understood who we really are, we would be very, very clear that nothing could be taken from us that could cause us to be robbed of our peace, our serenity, our love, our joy, our awareness, and our experience of who we really are. That can't be taken from us. Once we get to that side of the playing field, once we get to the other side of the board, we begin negotiating our pathway through life in an entirely different way. We suddenly understand the answer to the four fundamental questions of life. Who am I? Where am I? Why am I where I am? What do I intend to do here? We suddenly release our ideas that what we're here is to do is to somehow, you know, get a guy, get a girl, get a car, get a job, get a house, get the kids, get the grandkids, get the promotion, get the office in the corner, get the gray hair, get the retirement watch, get home, get sick, and get the hell out. Suddenly become aware there's something much more going on here, something very huge occurring in this process that we call human life. And when we become aware of that, we become almost eternally happy. You know, there's a guy who wrote a book about this called The Handbook to Higher Consciousness. His name was Ken Kies, Jr. Ken has since celebrated his continuation day, but he wrote this wonderful book, I'm going to say around 25 or 30 years ago, A Handbook to Higher Consciousness. I read the book and it changed my life. It was just one of several books, one of a half dozen books perhaps, that really, truly and significantly altered my understanding of everything. And I'm clear now that I was led to that book for that purpose. But I had no idea when I read the book, because the book was about a man who was talking about how to shift our consciousness from one of addiction to one of preference, how to what he would call elevate your consciousness from a consciousness of addiction to a consciousness of preference. He defined the two as this. If you experience that the loss of something, anything, a spouse, a loved one, a job, a house, a car, anything, your glasses, anything, if you experience that the loss of anything would cause you to be unhappy, would rob you of your happiness, then clearly you are addicted to having that thing. On the other hand, if you merely have a preference for that thing, its departure from your life will not rob you of your happiness. So his whole book was about how to elevate your addictions to preferences. It was a marvelous book talking about how one shifts one's consciousness to create the kind of life we were all intended to experience and to enjoy here. I did not know when I read that book that Ken Kies Jr. was paralyzed from the neck down as a result of a swimming accident in his teen years, and that he could virtually move no part of his body except for his head, and a tiny bit of movement in his arms, but not much. I met him late in life. I met Ken. He talked to me from his wheelchair, and I was astonished to see this frail body in this wheelchair that hadn't moved appreciably in 45 or 50 years, but a mind that was as brilliant and incisive and as joyful and as happy to be alive as any human being I've ever met. So I want to tell you that I've had some rich experiences in my life of noticing that you are not your body, and I've had some actual human beings demonstrate that to me right in front of my eyes, I would invite encourage anyone who's listening to me now to get that book. You can still buy it at the online bookstores. It's called A Handbook to Higher Consciousness by Ken Keyes, K-E-Y-E-S, Ken Keyes Jr.
Ken Keyes Jr. That's something to remember. Neil, what would you say to a person who happens to be terminal right now?
Much would depend on their state of mind. If they were in the state of mind of Fuzhu Trigon, I would probably say nothing. If they were in the state of mind of people who are desperately afraid and scared, I would tell them some of the things I'm saying to you. And I would say to them in short and in brief, first, I've been there. I've been on the so-called other side. You cannot even imagine or begin to imagine the glory and the wonder and the happiness and the joy you're going to experience in this process. Therefore, fear not. You know, be not afraid, but celebrate with joy. My mother was in that space. She was just really died very joyfully, very joyfully. She said, I'm going home to God, she said. I know this is going to make all of you very sad. But she says, you know, my mother said something to me I never forgot. I was in the intensive care ward. We each got 5 minutes with her every hour. She was there about 8 or 9 hours, and then she died. And during that time, Dad and her sons were allowed to step in for 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there, and not much longer because they didn't want her to be worn out, and they were still hoping that a blood transfusion and an operation could save her. Well, it didn't. She died on the operating table. That's another story. But the last time I saw her, she looked up at me and she said, with the biggest smile on her face, dance on my grave. Promise me. Dance on my grave. I said, I promise. The priest, my mother was a Catholic, went in. It was a young priest, as it happened, a very young guy. And he couldn't have been 24 years old. He was called from the parish to administer the last rites of the Holy Catholic Church, extreme unction, it's called in the Catholic tradition. And he went in there with his oils to anoint the body and do what priests do at moments like that. He came out about a half hour later, shaken, just really, to use an ill-turned phrase, white as a ghost. We said, Father, did Mom die? Well, are you all right? He said, no, she's very much alive. We said, what's going on? You look terrible. He said, I'm shaken to the core. I said, why is that? He said, I was in there, and your mother was comforting me. He said, in that moment, I became a priest. I would share those stories with anybody who was dying in front of me. I would hold their hand, and I would say, I'll walk you through this. I'll be here right through the whole process. I'm not going anywhere. But fear not. Nothing bad is going to happen here. It's going to be a wonderful, joyous experience. And when you have left your body, I'll take care of all your earthly concerns. Give me a list now of what you want to have done. Let's get that off your mind right now. And know that it will be done exactly the way you're asking it to be done. And then lay your head back in the pillow and rest. Rest. This part of your journey is over.
Oh, so beautiful. It just brings tears to my eyes. Okay, we're almost out of time, and I've got to ask you this final question. You wrote the book, Happier Than God, and it was because of the movie, The Secret, in which you were in, and the fact that it didn't cover enough spirituality for you. Could you talk about that a bit?
I was disappointed in the movie, The Secret, and in the book, even though I was a part of both, and I was given about a minute and a half in the movie. And I called the producers afterward and said, you know, not from a standpoint of ego, but simply an utter curiosity. You came here and filmed me for 2 hours, and you used about 90 seconds of me in the film, but many, 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 many minutes of other wonderful teachers. Did I offend you? Did something, just so I could know for the future, did something go wrong? Oh, no. Oh, no, not at all, Neil. It was wonderful to film you. We've got some incredible material from you. I said, well, then, out of curiosity, how come only 90 seconds of it made the movie? Well, you know, Neil, every other word you speak is God. God this, God that, God this, God that. And this movie wasn't about God. This movie was about an individual person's ability to manifest their own reality without having to rely on any other person, place, or source. So I thought, okay, reread the book, The Secret, which was nothing more than a transcript, essentially, of the movie, and I thought, gosh, you know, as valuable as this is, and I don't want to take anything away from that, as powerful as this information is, and as wonderful as it is that it has been shared with humankind, God bless the producers of that film, because, you know, thank you very much. But as wonderful as it is, it is the elementary school, the primary school, the pre-kindergarten school of metaphysics. And I realized that to try to eliminate God, or if you please, spirituality, from the process of personal creation is like talking about gravity without talking about weight. And I realized we can't, you know, so there's so much more that needs to be said here. So yes, I wrote the book, Happier Than God, to complete the data, to put into the space the missing data from The Secret, or the true secret of The Secret, although I didn't want to call it that. So I call it Happier Than God, and I brought forward some fundamental metaphysical principles that I believe that everyone who watched The Secret needed to have in order to be fully equipped to use The Secret in a way that would benefit themselves and all of humankind. What The Secret did not talk about, among other things, over many things it did not talk about, but the most important thing it did not talk about is, you know, if The Secret is that powerful, and if we're able to manifest new cars in our driveway, and even the 8-year-old boy with a new bicycle out in front of the house, or the woman with the new diamonds around her bodice, if we can, you know, manifest all these things that whatever the heart desires, as in the blink of an eye, with the power of positive thinking, why can't we produce peace on earth and goodwill toward human beings everywhere? What is the problem if we have this so-called magical power at our fingertips? And that's the question that The Secret did not address. It was a very hedonistic look at the most powerful force in the universe. It did, in fact, talk about all the money, all the riches, all the cars, all the houses, all the diamonds, all the bicycles you could ever want in your life are yours at your fingertips, but it said not one word about how to use this power to create a better world and to shift the reality of an entire planet. That was something that I felt needed to be remedied. And out of that desire, I wrote Happier Than God, which talks not only about how we can create our own reality in the way we would choose, but how we can, in fact, transform the world entire.
Yes, there is so much joy in shifting the consciousness of the world. That's what it's all about.
And you know, in conclusion, it goes even beyond that. It goes right to our raison d'etre, our very reason for being. What is the purpose of all of life? What am I doing here anyway? Is it really about he who has the most toys at the end wins? Or is that a kind of a shallow victory that really means nothing and will mean nothing to us at the time of our death? What is our real purpose for being here? What is my function in the world and in the universe? Who am I? And what am I doing here? These are the profound questions that spirituality and only spirituality can answer.
So understanding about death actually helps us to understand how to live. Wonderful. And we are out of time. But Neil Donald Walsh, thank you. Thank you, thank you for being such a blessing to this world.
You're very kind to say those things. Thanks for the opportunity and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Neil. And to all of the wonderful, glorious, magnificent listeners out there, have a wonderful holiday season. And we'll be back next week with another great show on Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
Thank you for choosing to be with us on Law of Attraction Talk Radio. Remember, let the ripple effect begin with you as we all connect together. If you have comments, please contact Jules at loaradionetwork.com. Have a happy week.